Classic Business with Michael Avery, sponsored by Alex Forbes, for insight, advice, and impact.
Welcome back to Classic Business. We turn the spotlight now onto one of the most remarkable self-help turnarounds on the JSE of recent memory, Tiger Brands. Long burdened by operational missteps, portfolio sprawl, and governance scars, has just delivered a set of full-year results that signal a very different animal emerging from the FMCG jungle. Revenue nudged ahead in a still anemic environment, but the real story lies beneath the top line. A 35% surge in operating income, operating margins through 11%, a fortress net cash position, and returns on capital that finally resemble those of a modern branded goods company. And at the same time, Tiger is undertaking one of the boldest portfolio reshuffles that we've seen in years, all while returning an eye-watering 5.5 billion rand to shareholders through ordinary and special dividends. So what a story. To unpack the numbers and the outlook, I'm joined by the man steering the turnaround, CEO Tjaart Kruger. Tjaart, welcome to Classic Business. And just looking at these numbers, it really is incredible. When you arrived, Tiger was seen as a classic sleepy incumbent with operational and governance issues. What were the one or two non-negotiables that you put in place to shift the culture and the performance? Because it seems very much that you're more focused on margins and chasing quality over quantity.
Yes. Hi, Michael. Yeah, thanks for chatting to me. Now, the couple of things that we did very, very early. The first thing was to change the operating model. We sat in a matrix-driven centralized structure where decision-making was very poor and execution was maybe even worse than that. So we changed the operating model and decentralized, really going to a federated model, appointing business leaders that were empowered to make decisions and that were held accountable for executing those decisions. I would say that would be the biggest change from, call it the old Tiger to the new Tiger. We obviously very bold to clean up the portfolio, made tough decisions to sell certain businesses, but made the decisions and executed on those decisions. And you can see the results. Good cash flows, a highly focused organization, driving scale and affordability, which is really what we're trying to do. And through that, we could get our price points down, get the volumes up at the right margin. So in a nutshell, that is probably what we've done over the last 2 years.
And looking at ROIC, that's climbed to 19.1%, your return on equity to 18.8%. Which parts of the portfolio, as you look at them, are currently dilutive to that hurdle? And what is your medium-term target for returns once the disposals and the restructuring fully wash through? Because now you're still busy with a very big restructuring and portfolio refresh.
Yeah, our guidance is ROIC must go over 20%. Very soon, and it must get towards 25% in the longer term, which is probably 3-4 years from now. That would be our guidance. If you take ROIC, the way we calculate it, it's calculated on an average basis. So it's closing opening balances. If you just look at the closing balance at the end of the financial period, that ROIC is actually hitting 20%. So if you look at the business, one of the big jobs that we've done over the last 2 years is working capital. So we took out about 3.5-4 billion rand out of working capital by just getting stock levels better managed. And the federated model contributed to that because each business unit must be responsible for carrying the right stock and not excesses. So getting working capital under control, which is a big contributor to ROIC, and then get the margins right. So if you look at the businesses that drags on ROIC, it's probably our culinary businesses where we've got working capital challenges, not insurmountable, but that's where you've got, you know, you buy a crop and then you sit with the whole crop for the year selling it out. Yep. That's the business model. So obviously you must get your margins up so that your return on invested capital is improved. We've got plans for all of those. We don't have any plans to get rid of any of those businesses. The 2-3 businesses that's still in the process of being disposed of is King Food. The Randfontein site is just about sold. We're waiting for Competition Commission authorization. Then we've got some work to do around our chocolate business that we spoke about in the last year or so.
Yeah, ChocoCam, you know, held for sale. If you look at where is Tiger gaining share today and in which categories do you believe you have the rightest clear right to win over the next 3 years, what would they be? And conversely, which categories still require significant turnarounds to become economically attractive for you?
Look, the businesses that we're keeping, even Chococam, that's not core to us, is a good business, good profitability business. It's other reasons why we're disposing of that, geopolitical reasons. King Food and Potch that we are disposing of, we've turned that around. The profitability is improving, but that also doesn't really fit into our mega brand strategy that we have. If you look at our focus in Tiger is to look at our 16 mega brands. They all got very, very good market shares. There's one or two that don't. I'll talk to them about just now. But in all the categories, in bread, in grains, Tastic Rice, Fatty Simonis, Jungle, in culinary, Koo, All Gold, Mrs. Balls, in Cross and Blackwell mayonnaise, in all those products, we've got demanding market shares. And we have actually in all those businesses grew volumes this past year through this focus strategy of affordability. And the affordability was only possible because we took a lot of costs out and we drove the right margins and got the price points right, and therefore the volume that we grow. We've got opportunity in all those categories to improve our market shares and improve our volumes through that, just by being more relevant to our consumer from a pricing and availability point of view. The brands are iconic. They just sell themselves.
Yeah.
There's one or two brands where we don't have those type of market shares. One of them is Ingram's. The margins are good, and Ingram's probably volumes are more in the neighboring countries, specifically in Zimbabwe. And there we've got work to do to have the right to play in South Africa. We've got lots of plans, but it's not a burning platform. You know, it's good margins. It's personal care. It's got a very good niche position in camphor, in mostly winter product, which is a bit of a problem because it's very seasonal. But we've got lots of plans there to rectify that.
And then another big theme in the market is obviously private label and trading down. Where is Tiger feeling the sharpest pressure from private label, despite that strength that you really got in those brands that have become household names that you've just mentioned? And where are you seeing that private label pressure and move into kind of value alternatives? And where do you just see an ability to still command that price premium without losing share because of the brand strength?
Well, the first thing is we want to make our brands more affordable. So we want to get to those premiums at a much smaller margin than what we thought we did in the past. So competing brands, and we view private label as a competing brand. We don't view it as something separate. So we want to get our products from a pricing point of view to be competitive with that. And what we're doing through innovation is to get tiered products that can even go lower in pricing and really compete with the, call it the cheap offerings. Tiered products, what we talk about is the one example that we will launch in March is a peanut butter that will have a differentiated branding on it. It will be Black Cat, but it will have a descriptor, something like Creamier, where we work on the recipe to get it really competitive from a pricing point of view. So what we do is we take more peanuts out and have multipliers and stuff in the product, and we can really get to those price points where the cheap house brands sit. And that's what we will do in all our products. We will look at how do we get our brands to be really affordable, really available to the consumer, and where we need to get to lower price points, we will look at tiering of the products. We will do the same in mayonnaise. We can get a mayonnaise, a different formulation that's much cheaper. It's not inferior.
Yeah.
Got a bit of a different taste profile, but it's a different, and it's at the right margin. We'll do this at the right margin. So if there's cannibalization, that's fine because the margins are okay.
Fascinating. And, you know, at the same time, on the other side of the aisle, so to speak, the retailers are getting bigger, smarter, more data-driven. How has that balance of power in the value chain shifted? Are you having more strategic conversations with the big chains around category growth, or is it still largely about just price and promotion?
Look, price and promotion will never go away, so it will always be there. But we are getting, as we're fixing our data, you can imagine if the counterparty has got better data than you, they will probably take you a bit. But as we get our data sorted out, and we're doing a lot of stuff in digitalization and getting our data sorted out so we can use it, and even going into AI, we've started some projects on that. So as we get our data that we've got really good data to talk about, we really sit strategically with retailers and plan stuff properly around how do you promote. Look, in some of the food categories, 50% of products are sold on promotion. So promotions are real, it's relevant, and if you don't know how to play in the promotional space, you won't sell too much, so yeah, we must do that. The big benefit we do have is if we can get our promotional activity right and we can get our role in how we play in combos right, our brands pull consumers into those combos and into those promotions. And we unashamedly is happy for our retailers and our customers, wholesalers, to use our brands for that. So that's why our brands are so strong. And we're not arrogant about that. We're very cooperative about that. And that's the strength of our brands. And we've seen that in the last year, how well it works.
Jeremy Sampson, who I call the brand father on Classic Business, that would be music to his ears. He always thought the previous management didn't fully lean into the strength of Tiger's brand portfolio. So it really is encouraging, and the numbers speak for themselves, that you are doing that chart. Just when we look at routes to market, if you look at the informal or the alternative channels, spazas and wholesalers and that route to market into township, I think is becoming much more important. How are you adapting Tiger's pack sizes and your price points and your route to market versus, say, 5 years ago?
Yeah. Look, there is also a lot of blurring between retail, wholesale, and that informal market. I mean, if you look at retailers like Boxer, they are really opening a lot of stores in those areas. That's been happening for a while, so, and that I'm sure that will continue to happen. Usafe and ShopRite does the same, and we're very comfortable with that. We've got in that informal market, or we call it the general trade, we started about 2-3 years ago with a project where we put a bit of technology into that space with putting people on the ground to go and collect orders from those spaza stores and place them on whatever we call the midi wholesalers, mini wholesalers, intermediates between the big wholesalers and the spaza stores, wherever they get their stock from, and help them with their shelves and help them with their layout and help them with their forward shares, and really place orders for them and get deliveries. And there's lots of runners in the townships that actually deliver to these spaza stores. So we started off about 3 years ago, and this last year, or right now, we're serving about 101,000 stores with that structure of ours. And we think it's quite a strategic, important activity to get into those stores, because those consumers are also our consumers. They consume our products and they want our products. And it's actually working quite well.
I've got to ask you just for your personal view on Pick and Pay. I think Boxer was probably one of the finest investments that Sean Summers ever made, acquiring the business for 180 odd million. They listed for 30 billion. But it was one of those listings that was pretty bittersweet given the financial position that Pick and Pay found itself in. Do you believe he's going to be able to turn that business around?
Yeah, I certainly think so. I think it's probably a bit tougher than what he thought and what any of us thought, because his competitors are also really, really flying. They're doing quite well. But I think Sean will turn it around. He's got the backing of his shareholders. Pick and Pay, I think, is still a wonderful brand. He's right-sizing and cutting still. He's still closing a lot of stores, and that makes the numbers not look so good. But you can see the turn. And, you know, if they just get things like price points off promo, on promo activities right, which they are busy doing, I don't think they had it right a couple of years ago. I think they'll get it right, but it's gonna take a year or two.
Absolutely. But I think Tiger is evidence that against Warren Buffett's maxim, sometimes turnarounds do actually turn. Certainly the numbers are there for all to see. Tjaart Kruger, CEO of Tiger Brands, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that was a compelling set of numbers in a very tough market and clearly a very different Tiger from just a few years ago. We'll keep watching the execution, the portfolio reshaping, and whether this cost discipline and margin strength can hold into 2026. Stay with Classic Business. More market-moving interviews coming up after the break.
Classic Business with Michael Avery, sponsored by Alex Forbes, for insight, advice, and impact.